Alex Sears is now one of our most popular writers and critics. He's worked out a really good methodology for himself, whereby once every 10 years he writes the definitive book about the previous decade in a certain type of British theatre. His most recent book, Rewriting the Nation, subtitled British Theatre Today, came out in January of this year, I think. And it does for the 2000s what he did in his definitive book, In Your Face Theatre, for the 1990s. Alex is one of those wonderful people who managed to coin a phrase which has become, it's come onto the lips of people throughout the nation, and it's amazing. Alex, do you want to tell us, first of all, about Rewriting the Nation? In particular, new writing. You use new writing not in the way that most of us would use it, i.e. writing that's new, so that could be by anybody from someone on TV to an author or whatever. You use it very specifically. So tell us about new writing.
Certainly. As you say, everybody knows what a new play is. It's basically a play that hasn't been staged before. But that actually, when you look into it, covers a huge terrain of contemporary theatre. So a new play could be a history play, it could be an adaptation of a classic novel, it could be a translation or an adaptation of a foreign play, it could be a play written by a whole committee of five or six people, it could be a pantomime, it could be almost anything. And indeed, I think the Arts Council now talk about new work rather than new plays, because there's such a variety of different pieces of theatre. And of course, they're all perfectly fine, and I've got nothing against those kinds of writing. But the kind of thing that interests me, the kind of thing that I'm passionate about, is what I call new writing, and what is identified as new writing by a whole huge group of people in that sort of part of British theatre.
This is not a phrase that you've coined, is it?
No, it isn't, no. It's definitely something that other people have talked about since the 1970s, more or less. But that kind of new writing is something that's really quite special. And the emphasis is on two things. On the one hand, it emphasises the individual playwright and their distinctive and individual and singular voice. And that's quite clear, really. If you look at plays by somebody like Carol Churchill or Richard Bean or Martin Crimp, or going further back, somebody like Harold Pinter, you can tell it's by them. They have a very distinctive way of writing and a very individual way of writing. So that's the one thing that really always wakes me up when I'm sitting in the theatre and I think I can hear, beyond the actual character types that are speaking this language, some sense of the writer behind that and their distinctive individuality, a kind of taste of them. And the other thing about new writing, of course, is that it's contemporary. If you look at a place like the Royal Court Theatre, which is one of the main new writing theatres in Britain, they don't do many history plays. In fact, they practically never do a history play. They don't do adaptations. They mainly do new plays by individual writers, with one or two very small exceptions where they've asked, I don't know, five women to write a play about the contemporary world. If new writing is contemporary, then of course it has to be contemporary in different ways. So one of the ways in which it's contemporary is that its use of language is recognisably contemporary. The second way in which it could be contemporary is it deals with contemporary issues. A third way, which is always for me a dream when I see a play like this, is that it does something thrilling with the theatre form, especially if that's a success. Mm. You know, sometimes we talk about experimentation with form, and it's just a shorthand for saying, well, that didn't quite work.
This could explain why you're the biographer of Martin Crimp, of course, who, with Carol Churchill, probably experiments in form more than anybody else.
Yes, and is influential simply because of that. A lot of young writers are obviously attracted by somebody who breaks the rules or pushes the boundaries out and helps redefine what's possible on the stage. And the fourth and final way of defining the contemporary is that it's some kind of a provocation. Now, obviously, it's very rare for all those four elements to be in a new play, and indeed, sometimes it simply doesn't happen like that. You have one or two of those elements, but without the others. But when you have all of them, I think I say rather sort of stupidly in the book, you can hear the champagne corks pop. You know, the literary managers are hugging each other, and the artistic director loves it. And if it fills the theatre, if it's successful as well, then bingo, you've got a really good piece of new writing.
Do you find there's a problem where provocation and offence meet each other? Or do you think that in a theatre, provocation almost can't cause offence in your eyes because it's permissible?
That's a good question, and it's a difficult one. I mean, I always think of royal court audiences as unshockable. And that the same kind of play that you've seen there, when it transfers to the West End, that's when you get real gasps. So I think Kleinborn Park, for example, that really filthy joke in the second half, in the Royal Court, everybody laughs and thinks it's fantastic. You know, it's provocative, all right, but it's on our side, if you like. It's on a liberal sort of agenda. In the West End, especially if you're not really prepared for that, I do wonder how people react and how much they are offended. But as a bigger answer, I think it's one of the duties of people who work in the arts to actually explore the things that we're least comfortable with, and that sometimes that does involve provoking audiences, yes.
And what about a comparison? You've written these magisterial books about separate decades. How do you compare the 1990s with the 2000s?
The 1990s, I use this scientific metaphor, is, for me anyway, relatively straightforward. A group of new writers, often very young, emerged and they influenced other writers. So I call it Newtonian. Okay, every cause has an effect. Everything is relatively simple to understand. It's a kind of revival of the idea of an avant-garde. So there's a group of writers and they're pushing open the doors and creating lots of opportunities. The noughties, or the 2000s, is completely different from the point of view of new writing. There isn't one major style of theatre in new writing. There's a huge variety. So it's kind of like some form of astrophysics or nuclear physics, when everything, quantum physics, everything is bouncing off the walls, and Schrodinger's cat is alive and dead at the same time, and there's a huge feeling of confusion, actually. I found it very difficult while I was trying to write about contemporary theatre throughout the past 10 years to actually focus and say, yes, this is a trend, or this is a new development. There are those things, but they're quite hard to pin down. Also, it's a decade which was magnificently rich in new writing. And I do wonder what will happen in the future with arts cuts, whether we'll have that kind of marvellous feeling of creativity that there was so much happening. On the back of an envelope one day, I made a calculation of how many new plays, and I think it's something like 3,000 have been staged in the past 10 years. And obviously, I've only seen about 300 of them, which is a very small proportion, really. And I go out, you know, two or three times a week, slightly less than you, of course, but still quite often. So it's a decade that's a bit like a roller coaster, because there's so much going on.
Then you also get what I regard as the Edinburgh effect, which is quantity over quality, that there are only so many good plays. And with 3,000, it may be that you've still got 50 good plays, but instead of with 1,000 where you have 950 bad ones, you have 2,950 bad ones. So I'm not sure necessarily that having vast numbers of plays helps. What it does mean is that younger writers get an opportunity to get their plays produced and possibly seen, possibly not.
Yeah, that's a very good point. In fact, I sometimes do worry about this correlation between generous arts funding and creativity. And certainly under New Labour, New Writing and theatre in general was very, very well funded indeed. And that was great, especially for theatre outside London. Yeah. You know, there are lots of theatres that would have closed if it hadn't been for that kind of generosity.
And may close next month.
That's also possible, unfortunately. But in the last 10 years, although there have been obvious new talents who have emerged or established their reputations, I mean, obviously Richard Bean, yes, Simon Stevens, Dennis Kelly, Debbie Tucker Green, people like Tanika Gupta have emerged, people like Roy Williams or Kwame Kweama have had important work put on in the decade. But there hasn't been such a decade-defining genius as Sarah Kane was for, yes, the 1990s. And so the correlation between spending a lot of money on the arts and actually getting, because you can't legislate for genius, it's so difficult. And as you say, making more and more theatre doesn't necessarily mean it's better and better theatre.
It was interesting in that list you named. You mentioned a number of Black and Asian writers. I think if you tried to do the same, just quick list of the main writers you think of for the previous decade, the In Your Face decade, you maybe might come up with one or two at most.
Yeah, exactly.
And what is that multiculturalism doing for theatre and going to do for theatre going forwards, do you think?
Well, I think in a way it's theatre catching up with what the rest,
absolutely,
of society,
yeah,
is like. I mean, you live in London, so do I. You travel on public transport, you're in the street. It's obviously a multicultural metropolis, and it has been for years now. It's so obvious. And yet the theatre for so many decades was very, very white indeed. And it still is in terms of the administration, the people who have power, and so on and so forth. So I can see why there have been schemes to try and alter that by promoting a more diverse or ethnically aware kind of agenda. I do sometimes worry about the results, though. I mean, at the Royal Court, you can fill the Royal Court with black school kids for a Roy Williams play, but don't they deserve to see a play by another writer, somebody from a different background? You know, why, it's another question, why do black writers almost exclusively write only about the black community? Now, I can understand why writers start out by writing about their heritage, but then when you move on, surely there are lots of other areas that they could explore. And just as it would be insulting to imagine that a black barrister could only represent black people, or a black journalist could only investigate stories if they were about the black community, so surely what you really want is black writers just to be writers, to write about a whole variety of things.
Do you think it may be artistic directors who feel that black writers and Asian writers should write about black and Asian issues?
Yeah, and obviously there are a lot of black actors and Asian actors who want employment, and why shouldn't they develop their careers by having lots of plays to choose from and so on and so forth? But I still think there's room for some kind of flexibility and development here that hasn't been quite grasped.
One thing that you don't do in the book is expand your vision beyond, I think the United Kingdom is probably the correct phrase, isn't
it?
So the reason I was being careful with that is it doesn't extend to Ireland, where there has still been an outgrowth of incredible new writing, if I may use the phrase, in that context.
Oh, absolutely.
Let alone the United States.
Absolutely, Philip, absolutely. And obviously, every time my books have been reviewed, I've been accused of being a sort of bigoted little Englander or a sort of London patriot or something like this. But the real reason for it is obviously sanity. I decided with rewriting The Nation that I've spread my net very widely, and I think various reviewers, including yourself, of the book have pointed out that I sometimes mention too many little plays that everybody's forgotten about. And that was partly intentional, because I've seen a lot of work, and partly to honour some playwrights that, while not major talents, were certainly part of the scene. And I've always done that. If you look at the introductions to individual chapters in Your Face Theatre, there is some account of the other work, new work that was going on at the time. You know, but if I really spread my net to include Ireland, I'd have had, you know, another 1,000 plays probably. The United States of America, I know only those plays that come to London. Unlike yourself, you go once a year or twice a year to the States, so you have some idea of what's actually happening now. I really don't. So it would have been so difficult. And I'm not sure, since one of the missions of the book was to write about images of national identity, whether actually Irish playwrights tell us much about who we are. I might be wrong. Of course, Beckett tells everybody who everybody is, but you know what I mean.
Understand.
Yeah, and American playwrights, obviously, their main agenda has never been to talk about the Brits or anything. So,
but maybe a play like Cliburn Park or a lot of other examples can speak to us because they are universal, despite the fact they are very much, and Cliburn Park set just outside Chicago.
I could see that there's an argument for including American plays, in that British culture is Anglo-American. I mean, if you just look at TV, for example. On the other hand, I think there are some things that we excel at as a playwriting culture, and especially in the production that you've already mentioned of dozens and dozens of plays, whether they're in Edinburgh or all around the country in straight theatres. And I think that's slightly different to the scene in America.
Going to see new writing, you're taking big risks. If you're going to see Shakespeare, the odds are you'll like it if you like Hamlet or Winter's Tale or whatever. If you go to see Chekhov, you know you're going to like it before you get there, otherwise you wouldn't go. With new writing, every time you go in, it doesn't matter who the playwright is, they can screw up. If it's a new playwright, you can't tell at all. You can only go on the strength of the theatre that's decided to commission them or pick up the play. Does your heart sink very often? Do you find yourself in theatres and thinking, oh God, I wish I was at home in bed?
Yes, it does happen often. And that's one of the reasons, I think, and not just to me, that a lot of critics sometimes give a very bad review to a show because of a sense of disappointment, that you feel let down, that you feel your time has been wasted, that you feel you could have done so much better at another venue that particular night, especially in London, which is so rich in its theatre. It's difficult. My worst nightmare is getting things wrong because I've only seen a play once. That's the other thing about our critical culture, and I suppose it's also a function of this enormous variety of things going on all the time, is that you're not really encouraged to go back time and time again to see a show. Or if you're going to write about it, you certainly would write about it just on the evidence of one showing. So that means if there's something that's difficult, intrinsically difficult, it probably gets a worse kind of press in this country than if it was a straightforward, rather soapy, easy to understand, naturalistic, linear play.
There has been a very long tradition of that. Look back in anger, Pinter, Beckett have all had bad starts. Sarah Kane, and blasted by the vast majority of the critics, who then mostly reassessed, often a decade later.
And I mean, I will defend critics in the sense that it's easy to snipe at people and say, oh, you got it wrong after the event. But when you're actually there, I do understand how difficult it is. After all, if it's an unknown writer, if they are innovating either in the sort of sensibility that they're presenting to you, or in the case of Blasted, in the form of the play, where one half is naturalistic and the other half is dreamlike, symbolic, whatever you like, it is quite difficult to grasp that. And it should be, because it is new. Mm-hmm. You know, it can't be new if you immediately understand mm-hmm. it. So you are sort of navigating in a sort of dark area, I think. And I do sympathise when people don't immediately get it. I don't think I immediately got blasted. Mm. I was lucky because a good friend of mine went to see it, and I argued with her about it, and she convinced me that it was good. But when you're actually sitting there, how can you tell? And there is a tendency, and I've fallen into this myself on countless occasions, of praising every single new playwright who arrives on the sort of hope that you've understood their work, that it is distinctive, and then finding that they didn't develop a career at all, that they've fallen by the wayside, or that actually they weren't such a good playwright because their second, third, fourth play has been more and more disappointing.
I think the other difficulty one suffers with new writing is it's very, very easy to understand and probably enjoy a simple melodrama or a sitcom. Mm. It's when something is more challenging. Mm. It may well be that, you know, over a period of time you begin to appreciate how clever it was or what it was trying to say or do. But again, that is a difficulty.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
So which writers do you have in mind? You've written books about two decades. I'm looking forward another 8-9 years to when we see the next one, obviously. Who are you spotting at the moment? Who do you think are the writers that are coming up and are going to be the people you might be writing about at the end of the decade?
That's really hard to say, actually. And I'm not even sure that I could answer that. I think that the playwrights who are emerging now were already emerging a couple of years ago, so I've caught some of them. Mike Bartlett, for example, is a very good example. Mm. Bola Igbaji, both Royal Court playwrights who are developing their careers. And there are a number of others that I've seen, but it's a very small amount. Nick Payne, for example, would be one good example. But I couldn't sort of talent spot. And in a way, it's not really my job to do that. It's the job of agents and artistic directors and directors to find new talent and to present their work. I don't often go to the outer reaches of the fringe. I don't often go to those very small, unfunded pub theatres where they have dozens of new playwrights every year, but mostly they're playwrights who you never hear of again, and quite often they're playwrights who direct their own work, which I always think is a rather bad sign.
What about that middle ground, the FIMBA, which has been having a storming time of late, the likes of James Graham and Angelus Garten?
Absolutely, yeah. They would be two people who I'm sure will develop their
Because that's careers, interesting, because there's a tendency to think new writing, Royal Court, maybe the Bush, and then you hope that half a dozen other theatres might have the odd good success. But suddenly the FIMBA is producing not necessarily as much new writing as the Court, but it's really doing a tremendous job.
And of course, if we're talking of smaller, fringy venues, then Theatre 503 for new writing, it's an actual specialist new writing theatre that runs on a shoestring. They have very high production qualities, I think. I don't see every show that's on there, but I see a lot, and they're always very vivid and very well realised on stage. With the FIMBA, I agree with that, what you've just said, and obviously those two names, yes. But I have a kind of snobby feeling about new writing, in the sense that I think that the best new writing is presented by specialist new writing venues who concentrate all of their resources on finding, on developing, and then on promoting a variety of new and older writers. Obviously, we shouldn't forget the fact that somebody like Martin Crimp is in his 50s, somebody like David Hare, who I still think is a new writer and has written some fantastic work, he's in his 60s. You know, we're talking, you know, Carol Churchill in her 70s. So there's a whole span of those writers, and I always feel that the best theatres for them are the ones that concentrate all of their resource on that. But I do acknowledge your point, and I do see that over the past 10 years, theatres with a mixed bag of programming, a kind of mixed ecology of work, have played an enormous part in the expansion of new writing.
The other area that's going to be of interest, I think, is the National Theatres. So,
yes,
National Theatre of Scotland is arguably the best new writing theatre in the country, in the nations, I suppose, at the moment.
Yeah.
And National Theatre of Wales, I don't know if you've seen any of their work, that's really
too new.
I'm
afraid I haven't.
But the principle of having these is great. One, again, one wonders what's going to happen with funding.
Exactly, yeah. And also, our National Theatre has had a, you know, the National Theatre under Nicholas Heitner has had an enormously strong record in promoting and developing writers. Kwame Kwayamar is the obvious example, but there have been several, and they've also given space to somebody like Ryan Craig, whose play The Holy Rosenbergs we saw last night, both of us.
And I think we're both strongly recommending.
Exactly. You know, so there is that as well. And the RSC also promotes and develops new writing, though I always think they do it in a slightly intractable form, quite often by asking young playwrights or middle career playwrights to respond to Shakespeare, which I think is a very difficult thing to do, and I'm not sure it's the best way of getting the best kind of new writing.
I think you can, but the hit rate isn't nearly as good as it ought to be.
No, I don't think so. If you compare memorable plays from the RSC over the past 10 years with those of the National, I think the National wins hands down. However, it's then open to accusations of being populist. You know, Kwame Kwayamar's plays are quite traditional in form. They're issue plays, they're linear, they're instantly comprehensible, more or less. So maybe, you know, it's very difficult to navigate that area between the populistic and, oh, that's, you know, too easy, and the really quite difficult, that's too difficult and doesn't quite make sense.
Alex Sears, thank you very much indeed. Rewriting the Nation is published by Nethune Drama and is readily available in all good bookshops.
Thank you, Philip.